Well, I think I'll get started because we're nearly at 5 past, and hopefully we'll have a lot of questions and a lot of discussions. And yeah, very, very pleased to have so many people here and to have such a great panel. And good evening, everyone, or good morning, or good afternoon to people who are joining from different time zones. I know people are here from all over the world. I'm Rachel Aldred. I'm a professor of transport here at Westminster University, and I'm going to be chairing the event. It's part of the Westminster Conversation Series, and it's entitled What is Neurodiversity and Why Should I Care? So before I introduce our speakers and the event format, I just wanted to say two things fairly quickly. So firstly, to very briefly define neurodivergence and neurodiversity as a starting point for people who may not be familiar with those terms. And my apologies for being oversimplistic and/or opinionated for those who are experts. The way that I understand it is that neurodivergence refers to a range of conditions that involve differences in brain functioning from what we might call a neurotypical norm. So we're talking about, for instance, conditions like autism, dyslexia, ADHD, and many more, although with ongoing debates about what counts as neurodivergence, which we may pick up on later here or another time. Neurodiversity, by contrast, I see as being about recognizing that such differences in brain functioning and processing are part of wider human diversity. As a species, we've got tremendous variety in how we think and how we perceive the world. And neurodivergence, I guess, is one part of this. For me, the concept of neurodiversity is part of creating spaces in which we can all flourish rather than us all being forced into a neurotypical norm. I think neurotypicality, like many binaries, doesn't even work well for those of us who can fit into that supposed normal category more easily. Anyway, our speakers will, I'm sure, add their own perspectives on this. The other thing I wanted to say was why I'm here doing this. So at the end of summer 2021, I was diagnosed as autistic. And for me, this has led to many things. But one of them, I guess, stereotypically enough, has involved sort of diving into some of the literature around autism, neurodiversity and disability. And I wanted to help share these ideas and discussions, particularly in as much as they can help make life more livable for neurodivergent people. And in personal terms, I wanted to clearly identify myself as being autistic and neurodivergent, and partly because I know that my professional privilege means I don't experience the risks in doing this that a lot of other people might. But alongside this also, I'm aware that my experiences as a white, cis, middle-aged, autistic woman professor are quite different from many other autistic people's experiences, and I should know when to stop speaking and listen and amplify other people's voices, which leads on nicely to introducing the panel and the format of the event. At this point, I would also like to thank the University's Equality, Diversity and Inclusion team and the College Disability Network for supporting the event, Colleague Disability Network, sorry, for supporting the event, and China Merriman and Sadia, who are student interns helping with the event organisation. So we've got four great speakers, and each of them is going to speak for 5 to 10 minutes on the event theme. After each of these intros, I will ask one or two questions based on what they've said. And then after all four of them have said their bit, I'll open up the panel discussion with a couple of questions and also ask questions from the audience. So if you have a question for one or more speakers, please type it in the Q&A, and I'll ask as many as I can when we get to the panel discussion. But feel free to type in your question at any point. It would be ideal not to get them all at once at the same time, and we'll finish no later than 6:30 p.m. So I'm going to introduce the speakers one by one as I ask them to do their introductions. Unfortunately, Char Bailey has had to drop out today due to illness, but Jill Corbin has very kindly agreed to be a late replacement to the panel. So first up, we've got Elliot. Dr. Elliot Spaeth is a lecturer in academic and digital development at the University of Glasgow. He specialises in inclusive learning and teaching in higher education, which involves helping lecturers think about how they can teach in a way that allows all their students to thrive. He is trans, disabled and neurodivergent. So I'll hand over to Elliot.
Thanks very much. I've got some slides, he said, expecting everyone to recoil in horror. So I will just briefly share those whilst I have a slight pause there. So I just wanted to share a few things that come up quite a lot in the work that I do and that are particularly important to me in relation to neurodiversity. So I wasn't diagnosed as neurodivergent until about 10 years ago, and it made quite a big difference to how I saw myself. And that relates to some of the things that are going on in these slides. So Rachel's already given a definition of neurodiversity, and a way that I quite like to think about it is sometimes in relation to social norms. So people sometimes say, I don't really like the division between neurodivergence and neurotypicality, which is entirely fair. But I think that the language, although perhaps not nuanced enough, can be useful for people who might identify with a way of being that isn't what society expects and pushes us towards. So within that concept, I would use the term neurotypical to refer to people whose brains align with societal norms and expectations, and the term neurodivergent for those whose brain function differently. And there's a bunch of diagnostic labels that would be associated with that that you might have heard of, like autism, ADHD, dyslexia, Tourette syndrome, dissociative identity disorder, lots more. And I don't think the specifics of the label is important. What's important is that, as has been mentioned, a lot of people perhaps being pushed to interact and behave in a way that might not really suit them. This is particularly relevant within the context of higher education, because a lot of neurodivergent traits are highly desirable for higher education, such as intense passion and curiosity for areas of interest, ability to focus and be really productive when engaged, or different ways of thinking that can enable someone to identify patterns and solutions that others might miss. But our norms about how we expect people to behave are used to define rules and expectations, especially around things like ideas of good or appropriate or professional behavior and typical workplace practices, teaching practices, research practices. And that tends to be based on this assumption that everyone's behavior means the same thing, that everyone has the same needs and preferences. And anyone who does something different might be called inappropriate. So for example, right now I'm sitting cross-legged, and I've been told more than once in my life, but that's unprofessional. But why? Like, what is it contributing to? If my job is helping people understand things, for example, how is me sitting cross-legged preventing someone else from understanding someone? In fact, it makes me physically more comfortable. So it'll probably make me better at it. So that's just one example. But to give a few more that might help you think about this in relation to your own experiences, somebody might ask a lot of questions, and you might feel like they're doubting your expertise, but it might be just that they really want to understand and make sure that they have the right understanding of what it is that you're trying to tell them. Or somebody might be doodling in a meeting, and to you it's frustrating because it seems like they're not paying attention. But it might be that actually their brain can't really focus without having that additional stimulation to keep their attention. Or it might be that someone really shuts down whenever you give them constructive feedback, and it feels like they're just refusing to engage with you, but really they're feeling overwhelmed and just need a bit of space. And the thing that brings all of these things together is the idea about how we should, in air quotes, behave is often defined by rules that just don't really actually make sense for a lot of the population. So perhaps for some people, yeah, if they did ask a lot of questions, that would be because they were doubting your expertise. But it's that assumption from them that, of course, that must be what everyone's doing. And so I think when it comes to neurodiversity, what's really important is not that you automatically know what everyone else's preferences and needs might be in advance, but just that you're open to people knowing what works for them and being able to learn, rather than assuming that you always know what's best for everyone. And I think that that's all I really had to say. Oh no, I had a bit more, sorry. I think that the other important thing is the impact of being repeatedly misunderstood. So it often feels that when the things happen that I mentioned before, that it's as if someone's saying, oh, you're just not trying hard enough, or you've got poor intentions. Like, if you just tried a bit harder, you'd be an acceptable human being. And it's quite hard to push that off when you're being told it like repeatedly every day for your whole life, essentially, like, well, why are you doing it that way? That way's wrong. And it's got an emotional impact in that it's not very fun for self-esteem. It's got a practical impact in that you have to make this decision between doing things the way that suits you and enables you to thrive, or doing things in the way that other people are likely to prefer, even though it's not necessarily related to them. And so a lot of us might learn things like masking, which is the idea that we're kind of conditioned into changing our behaviors to be considered more acceptable. And sometimes there's the argument that we should sort of take off the mask, i.e. try and behave authentically. But it's just not really that simple, partly because it's become part of our personalities now, but also it can be really dangerous to take off that mask and behave in the way that actually is comfortable and natural for us. And as Rachel said earlier, particularly so if you're multiply marginalized. So I'm white, which means that me behaving in a way that society thinks is a bit unusual is less dangerous than it might be if I were a person of color, as we can see by a lot of the news that comes in. And on that quite depressing note, that is me this time.
Brilliant. Thank you, Elliot. What you started off with kind of made a question pop into my head, and you talked about how higher education in many ways selects for neurodivergent, you know, people who are passionate, focused, engaged, and so on. So I kind of wondered, why are so many higher education institutions so bad at dealing with neurodivergence when, in a sense, they do select for it?
My personal feeling about it is that it's because people are focusing more on conformity and control than on the actual outcomes that they might want from a higher education institution. And that's where questions of power really come into it. And I think if people really, and that's kind of the work I try to do, to try and help people think about what is their actual goal? Because if it's to help people thrive or be more productive or whatever, then actually, usually enforcing one way on everyone isn't really actually going to achieve that. But sometimes I think that goal is lost sight of, and instead people are just making that assumption that they know that X will be the way of achieving that goal, and they can't see past whatever X may be.
Cool. Thank you. I'm sure we'll pick up on more questions related to this later. Actually, no, let me ask another one first. Just wondering about potentially impacts on teaching practices. I wondered if you could say something about how being aware of neurodivergence and neurodiversity might or should impact teaching practices, if you had thoughts on that.
I have many. I mean, it is the specialist thing that I tend to do. I think what's really important about it is the attitudes that comes through to your students, often based on how you interact with them and the decisions that you've made. And it's not that you're expected to know magically what will work for everyone, but it's about being open to learning that maybe the way that you thought of doing things might have an impact that you hadn't thought of with people. And so trying to build in flexibility from the beginning. And if someone does feedback to you that something isn't really great for them, not that you immediately, desperately, like absolutely have to change it, but just to take that on board and go and have a think about whether there is a way of building in flexibility, rather than sort of reflexively being like, no, because it's kind of scary having to deal with that and adapt quickly.
Sure. Oh, we've always done it this way, so I can't imagine doing it differently.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm sure we'll return to some of these issues, but at this point I'm going to move on to Atif. So Atif Chowdhury is an award-winning social entrepreneur with a background in economic justice and disability inclusion. Focusing on the inclusion of marginalised communities, Atif has worked on high-profile social development projects across the world. He's the co-founder and CEO of Diversity and Ability and Zaytoun CIC, the world's first fair trade Palestinian olive oil cooperative, advisor to the World Health Organization, Rapid Assistive Technologies Board, and trustee for Disability Rights UK. So I'd like to invite Atif to speak for 5 to 10 minutes, and then I'll ask him one or two questions based on that. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Rachel. Thank you, everyone, my fellow panelists, everyone taking the time to listen today. So I probably have a position on this that might be different, but then I suppose we all have a position on this that will be different, and that's the joy of neurodiversity, isn't it? That we paint the world, we navigate it through love, through joy, through celebrations, and often sometimes through denial and loss. And those sort of things are how we navigate the world. It gives us the map. You know, trauma, it adds to that map. And of course, the ability just to feed yourself or be part of a family that's able to focus on that comfortably is a big part of these stories. As you said, I'm an advisor to the World Health Organization on this work. I still think neurodiversity has come a long way in these conversations. But I think it's deeply, and I'm trying to read the room and the sort of the atmosphere of what the room wants, but I also need to be sincere to my own stories here. And I suppose I think that there is a danger in the current way of looking at neurodiversity that we are sleepwalking into. I don't think the intention is to do anything but goodness here, but the current dialogue on neurodiversity for me very much is Eurocentric in its entirety. It's reinforcing that Eurocentrism at every point. And it's a shame because it's such a missed opportunity of joy and learning and leaning in from other experiences. And so there's something deep about what we do about that. I have my own focus on it, and I present on this, and I've written a course called Neurodiversity, Race and Realities. And it's designed to move this Eurocentric needle from a space that's much more based on curiosity and humility, rather than the defiance of saying, this is what it is, and this is our club, and if you want to be in it, then these are our rules. Because it's not actually helping anybody. I'm not convinced it's helping a lot of folks. I think we have a lot to do on neurodiversity to grow into something far more inclusive and mature that recognizes that diagnosis is helpful for so many people. It's deeply healing. It was for me in lots of ways. But it's also designed around a particular context and a particular class group and a particular gender, I would argue. And in that space, we haven't, not only have we not asked what other nation states or people or communities would interpret neurodiversity would be, but we've decided they're less developed if they don't do it our way. And then we ask ourselves, how come so many brown folks are hard to reach? Now, we're never hard to reach. We are easy to ignore, and we always have been to a large extent. And this is a 400-year-old conversation, but it is trying to take a real deep breath and say, look, if we don't have an intersectional understanding of neurodiversity, we're probably not going to have a relevant one. What we will have is an illusion of you're neurotypical until one day you're not. Because up until someone got a diagnosis, and I suspect most of us on this panel, well, we're neurotypical until one day we're not. But what does it even mean? You know, what does it mean to say someone's neurodivergent and someone isn't? And so on. So I'm probably a lot more excited about what this conversation does to strengthen participation from a global context, what it does for the lessons that we need to learn about inclusion and participation from those who have learned to wear labels and are comfortable in them and find healing in them, and those who see those labels as deeply rooted in shame, and that with that shame is powerlessness and the confrontation that culturally is not something you can talk about because your people don't talk about it. Or when you're in a staff group and the people who are talking about autism, well, they look nothing like you. Or that you recognize that there are repercussions for you because of the job opportunities you access that are not the same as the job opportunities that other people talking about neurodiversity are able to access. These things play a tangible role in what we understand neurodiversity to be, but I think they're largely missing from the conversation. And I suppose that comes with a heavy sigh on my part, you know, that it's there. And I often wonder, I sort of think, look, we're in, as I said, but to be kind, is that it is an intergenerational piece of work. We are going to be taking on these conversations over the next 60 years before they reach a place where we can say, look, so much wrongdoing has happened here. Here is Africa. It's an incredible continent. Not a single border here. You can look at it. Was made by Africans. So what do we learn from the perception of neurodiversity from people who are Ashanti people or Maasai, and how would they have talked about it? But we'll never know, because as large as that continent is, not a single part of it has not been touched by the judgment of European education and what European education standards are. So then if we're then to look at neurodiversity and say, well, this is about a model that's universal, well, no, it's not. It's deeply not. And then we're sort of saying, so what we have we got? Well, we've got a model of a lot of folks deeply trying to look for belonging and deeply needing that and deeply feeling lost, be they black or white, rich or poor, that belonging is what they're seeking. So sometimes finding a diagnosis, and as I said, my own experience, that would be true. Finding a diagnosis is deeply healing because it says, at last, I've been desperate for this moment in my life. And you come to terms that this was the big jigsaw piece that you're missing. But I suppose, what if it wasn't? I'll end on this just for a moment. What if it was one of the jigsaw pieces missing? And there's some really good ones out there that we're yet to find. And that this one is helpful, but it's not the only one. And what are we doing that may be preventing other people from accessing the very same support mechanisms that we felt we needed in our own lives, because we created some labels and we defined our experiences, or more importantly, their experiences, through those same labels. I hope that's okay.
Fantastic. Thank you, Atif. It's really brilliant to have your input. And I wondered would you be able to say a little bit more perhaps about overcoming those barriers and about what needs to happen, I wonder?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose, yeah. So, I mean, at the heart of what I've just talked about is probably more to do with, you know, historical and structural racism, which plays a big role. Because, look, if you have to do more in the workplace to get further in the workplace, you're hardwired to share less. So when it comes to people coming forward about neurodiversity, it's really easy to say, come forward, talk about it, celebrate it, look at those differences. Not everyone gets that offering. Some will, and even if they do it, that doesn't mean you will, even if you're in the same workplace. So it's trying to recognize that the key part of it, there are structural imbalances, and I suppose that's really what I'm touching on. How do you look at those? I suppose I've said enough about those structural imbalances being still preventing the maturity of neurodiversity conversations to really happen ahead of us. But I generally believe, and I truly mean that I wouldn't be doing this work if I didn't feel that was going to happen and the role that we get to play in it. So I think the neurodiversity conversation is about, look, who has the psychological safety? I'll put things in the chat here for people to pick up on as well. But who has the psychological safety to play at this and to be safe on the other side of it? Not everyone does, and even those from different class backgrounds don't necessarily do just because they have access to privilege or wealth. But it is recognizing that we move at these psychological safety spaces or the speed of trust. But we do need more folks to be excited about the differences, the talents that come with that, but also to take a deep breath and sort of recognize that talent and trauma, they're not diametrically opposing forces. They live sometimes in the heart of the same person, in the same brilliance, all at the same time. But how do we get that talent to be seen when that trauma is perhaps needing to still find its voice? And so those two things sit here consistently in so many people, but often it takes a lot for us to find that out. We've structured a society, haven't we? We've structured a world on the lenses of powerful elitism, and those structures have come from contexts within the world, particular contexts that have been very brutal in the way they've constructed that. So much of us, I think, I would say everyone on this panel might be an example of that. We're a construct of our survival. And there's joy and beauty in that we found that survival. And we even found at times solace and kindness in labels. But we're not necessarily always a construct of our growth that said, this label was helpful and it's useful, but it's not the sum whole of me. This label is helpful and it's useful, but it's not the sum whole of that other person either. And so it goes back to the social economics of people participating in these conversations, the class barriers that they're facing to make these conversations easier. And of course, you know, the extension of that, of the misogyny they're facing, the homophobia and the racism and all these things, they will intersect into the realities of who's participating in intersectional realities of neurodiversity and who just never will.
Thank you. I think I'm going to be going back and listening to this afterwards again. I'd like to now ask our next panelist, Mary, to say something. So Dr. Mary Doherty is a consultant anaesthetist with over 20 years of experience in health services. She founded the peer support and advocacy groups Autistic Doctors International and Autistic Medical Students. She seeks to improve healthcare outcomes for the autistic community and to challenge the tragedy, narrative and stigma associated with autism. So, Mary.
Thanks, Rachel. Gosh, Atif, thank you. I would much rather sit here and think about what you have just said than talk right now, because that was fascinating and very, very much in alignment with, you know, how I feel about, you know, all of this. I think that intersectionality is absolutely becoming a vital part of this conversation, and I agree with you, it was not up until quite recently. And I think, yeah, it's a challenge to all of us, and particularly, you know, I mean, for myself, leading ADI, which is Peer Support and Advocacy for Autistic Doctors, there's over 600 of us at this point. You know, for me as a middle-aged, white, cis, privileged woman, with a medical degree, you know, and a job, it's really difficult for me to, you know, to even address that from my position of privilege. But I guess the first step is recognizing that privilege, and that privilege that, you know, that we all do share. I mean, intersectionality is something that we're very conscious of in ADI, because one thing that I notice about our organization is that our Zoom calls look very different to the Zoom calls that I have in other autistic or neurodivergent spaces. Simply because I think medicine is so culturally diverse anyhow, you know, so we do have, you know, a lot of members, you know, from various ethnic backgrounds from all across the world. But again, it is still very much Eurocentric, very, very white, you know, very, very, very much cis, very white, very exactly as you say. And it is something that we are very conscious of and working to address, because those intersectionalities, they multiply, for sure. They absolutely do. And even in our organization, I mean, while most people are, you know, managing absolutely fine, those members who do tend to run into difficulties, overwhelmingly tend to be the members that, you know, are from Black or ethnic minority backgrounds. You know, and I remember the first time I ever talked about this. This wasn't at all what I planned to talk about, but it's just, you know, it's just too interesting. I remember one of the first talks I ever gave on neurodiversity in medicine, and it was for the British Medical Association. It was a couple of years ago, maybe three and a half years ago now. And that was one of the very first questions that I got asked was from a doctor from South India, I think. You know, and he just said, "What about us? Well, you know, what about people from, you know, the global South? Do you know, what are you doing there?" And I have to be honest and say that it, at that point in my journey, it really hadn't crossed my radar at all, because I was only just starting out in this work, in this advocacy. And I think that's the case for a lot of people. People just, you know, come into the world of neurodiversity, and there's just so much to absorb, particularly when, you know, when it's relevant to us, and it involves that reframing of our entire lives. Just looking back at seeing everything that we've experienced up until the point of recognition or diagnosis, and just sort of reframing that and viewing it through that autistic or otherwise neurodivergent lens. I think that just takes up a lot of time, a lot of mental energy, and a lot of, you know, for several years, you know, for a lot of people, it takes several years to just work through all of that. And I think, as well as that happening on an individual level, I think that's happening on a wider scale in terms of the movement, the neurodiversity movement. And I think it is sort of moving more towards that, you know, that intersectional, you know, position, where it's just simply not acceptable anymore to, you know, only have panels of, you know, cis white people, for example, or, you know, not to address the issues, you know, by people from other ethnic groups. So I think we're getting there. You know, I do think the awareness is increasing. But absolutely, we've got so much more to do. You know, I think of the kids coming behind us, and so much of what I do is all around just making it better for the next generation of autistic and neurodivergent people, you know, and helping people to just grow up with a good, solid self-identity, just knowing that we're perfectly good autistic or neurodivergent people. You know, we're not failed neurotypicals, you know, and for so many of us that have come to diagnosis late, we've had to battle through that one. Whereas the kids coming behind us, there's a chance to do things differently. And very particularly, I think, for, you know, for Black kids, you know, who absolutely cannot, you know, they don't, you just don't have the privilege, for example, that my kids do, to be, you know, openly autistic and mask, you know, not needing to mask, or, you know, openly stimming or whatever, you know. And I agree, it is really important that we recognize those differences. I'll stop rambling there for now. leave it at that.
Thank you, Mary. Could I just ask you before we move on, if you could say something specifically about sort of changes you've seen, perhaps in terms of specifically the medical field, have you seen things change for the better in terms of neurodivergent people, neurodiversity, and just say something about that. Oh my goodness.
The difference in 3 years, it is phenomenal. Like 3 years, yeah, it was 2.5 years ago. I gave my very first talk with a colleague, and we did it together because neither of us would have had the courage to do it alone at the time. And we gave a talk on autistic doctors, which we subtitled Not an Oxymoron, because it was such a taboo at that point in time that I don't think anybody had ever spoken, you know, publicly with the word autistic and doctors in the same sentence. They didn't refer to patients. And that was at a medical conference in Oslo. It was a physician health conference. And since that point, we've got to a stage now where neurodiversity in medicine is absolutely the hot topic in medical education circles, both at undergraduate and postgraduate level. The awareness is just there. It's everywhere. Now, not everybody's on board, of course, but at least everyone's aware of it at this stage. There's an unfortunate sort of association, which I hope is temporary, because what's currently happening is the recognition that loads of our colleagues are autistic or neurodivergent. That's there. But what's a challenge is, because of the stigma, people who are not in any sort of difficulty generally tend to not disclose. So the ones who are coming out are those who either have to come out because they need reasonable adjustments, or they're being outed by their deaneries, for example. They've been sent off for assessment because they failed exams, or, you know, they're having, you know, the typical challenges that we all run into. So there is this association between being a trainee in difficulty and being neurodivergent. And that's really unfortunate, because, like, that's not the case. I mean, most of our members are managing absolutely fine with, you know, couldn't be described as, you know, doctor in difficulty at all. Most people are absolutely fine. But those people, particularly the more senior people, tend to generally not disclose. So I'm hoping that negative association will dissipate as, you know, as more people do come out. But huge changes, which also has beneficial effects for the wider neurodivergent and autistic community in terms of healthcare.
Great. Thank you very much. Just going to move on to Jill, who's our last panelist, and then I can see we're getting a number of questions in. We'll be able to have a discussion, asking questions of the panel, and you can answer as you wish. So, Jill, thank you very much for joining the panel today. Jill is the founder and director of Neurodiverse Connection, a community interest company established to improve support and outcomes for the neurodivergent population. Jill specialises in working with health and social care teams, particularly supporting improved understanding of sensory and social processing differences. Jill was the lead author on the co-produced papers It's Not Rocket Science, Reviewing Sensory Environments in Inpatient Services and Supporting Autistic Flourishing at Home and Beyond, Considering and Supporting Sensory Needs in Housing. So, Jill.
So much. Really good to be here, and great to hear what's been shared so far. So I'm going to share a little bit about my experience, personal and professional. So I, as a teenager, I had a really, really tough time. I knew that I was different, but I had no emotional literacy. I didn't have the words to describe it to myself, let alone to describe it to someone else. I had a sense of otherness, and I felt isolated and afraid, and I had no sense of what was wrong or what I could do about it. And so I spent a lot of my teenage years dysregulated, hurting myself, trying to avoid conflict and challenge, and had some time in hospital, and I found solutions that I think served me and kept me alive, but also brought problems of their own. And when I found recovery in my early 20s, and I was taught in this recovery forum how to be in the world. So people taught me how to make a cup of tea and how to greet people and how to be part of a meeting and how to have a conversation and how to interact and how to know and be what was expected of me in the world. And I did pretty well at it for I don't know, how long has it been? 16 years. And I, you know, when there are clear and explicit expectations, I can often meet them. But I really exhausted myself and ran myself into the ground. I describe it to people as it's like I have a different operating system, or, you know, like I'm part of a, I've got a computer and my computer's set to hard and everyone else is set to easy. Or, you know, like in every conversation and every interaction, I'm needing to translate and work it all out mentally before I can engage. And I kind of, I don't know, I'm sure it wasn't by accident. I'm sure, you know, I think we kind of, we quite naturally find our people and we gravitate to people that we can be ourselves and be comfortable with. And I developed an autism program that was reviewing sensory needs in hospitals, because some of my autistic colleagues found that they physically couldn't get into the buildings. And so I wondered what that might be like for autistic people who are in hospital. And we started reviewing the sensory environments, and I was following these colleagues around and identifying with a lot of what they were describing. And they were giving words to experiences that I'd never heard described before. But it took me a couple of years, because, you know, I thought that a lot of my experience and my way in the world was as a result of trauma. And so it took a while for me to be open to the fact that I might also be autistic. And I remember I asked a colleague, like, you know, do you think I'm autistic? And he said to me, Jill, I remember the first time we met and I looked at you through the service station doors. There were some big glass doors. And I could tell by the way you were standing that you're autistic. And there's lots of evidence to support that in our work since. So at that point, kind of actually as Mary described, like, actually I was doing okay in life. Like, I had a job and I had a house, and I was passing very effectively. Like, my masking and camouflaging skills were very well developed. But I really was I felt really compelled to get my diagnosis and to identify myself in the world, because of how difficult it had been. I thought about my experience as a teenager and how if I'd met someone when I was in hospital, if I'd met someone coming around who also had scars on their arms, who also, you know, had had a tough time, but had made it to adulthood, and had the dog of their dreams, and, you know, was doing things in life and felt okay in themselves. I think that, yeah, I really feel the responsibility to speak about coming through the hard times. So I got my diagnosis, and I work a lot with particularly health and social care teams. And really supporting them to understand neurodivergence. So understanding our sensory processing and how it's different, understanding our social processing and how it's different, understanding how all of these inputs actually can be cumulative. And just because I can tolerate something one day doesn't mean that I can tolerate it the next. I work with teams a lot around understanding the nervous system and regulation, and particularly how sensory and social processing can really impact what it's possible for us to tolerate, and how a lot of the young people that I work with are very dysregulated. And when we just treat the symptom, you know, when we just treat the eating disorder, for example, actually we really miss an opportunity to see the whole person and to support all of their needs. So, you know, I talk to teams about autism being like a filter through which I experience everything. And if they try and just strip out one part of my life or you know, one challenge and miss the autism-informed approach, then the chances are it won't work or it won't last for me. And I think that's really true of a lot of the people that I'm working with. So what we do now is we try and support changes to sensory and social environments to make them more predictable, more tolerable. And really with that kind of like universal design approach. So actually we want spaces that anyone can be comfortable in and feel safe in and can be regulated in, and spaces where everyone can belong. Yeah, and I think, you know, the why should I care bit, actually, you know, I really, when I got my diagnosis, I really thought for me, this is going to be a bit of paper. Like, I already work with people who I like and who get it. And I'm still having those, oh, this is an autism thing. Like, I'm still having, a couple of years on, I'm still having these revelations. It's enabled me to give myself more grace and accommodation and understanding. And to really take my needs seriously and think about what boundaries I need to have in place in order to meet them. It's helped me to celebrate some of the positives. So the real joy that I got today from being out in the frost, you know, the crunch underfoot, the patterns on the leaves and in the grass, like, and I can really celebrate these like small moments in life that I might have diminished or kind of overlooked before. And it's really given me an incredible connection to a really fantastic group of people. And it's, I kind of, you know, I feel like I'm part of a thread, so I'm able to get support from other people and I'm able to give support to other people. And, you know, I think part of that is kind of as simple as sharing my experience. And, you know, and it's, yeah, it's really inspiring to hear the ways that the panel members are kind of, yeah, carrying the message and supporting others to be seen and heard and understood. I think I've probably spoken for long enough, so I'll leave it there, Rachel.
Thank you, Jill. Thank you very much. I'll just ask you a question quickly before I start. We've got, yeah, a number of questions, just one or two that I was going to ask everybody myself. I mean, so you're talking about working with service providers in terms of creating more inclusive environments. So what's the kind of main barriers to getting that change, do you think?
I think the big one is that people still, there is this misconception of, so particularly I work around autism, but actually I think commonly a lot of other neurodivergent folk are similarly adversely affected by challenging environments. But I think that the biggest issue that I try to challenge is that this is a behavioural issue. And it's really not understood as a sensory and social processing difference, as a neurological difference. And so I think a lot of the barriers to change are in that misunderstanding.
Brilliant, thank you. I'm just looking at a list of questions. So yeah, I would just like to really thank all the panelists for their contributions. And yeah, I, as I say, I'm going to have to listen to this again, possibly several times. So thank you all very much. I have a few questions that I would, several questions I just wanted to ask myself, and then there's a number from the floor as well. So a first question I wanted to ask about was around, you know, diversity and neurodivergence. So neurodivergent people obviously a very diverse group in terms of a lot of intersexual characteristics, as well as in terms of neurodivergence as well, and, you know, that sometimes potentially conflicting needs. So I wonder if anyone would like to reflect on sort of how we join together to get change despite these differences, if anybody would like to respond to that. a take.
Yeah, I mean, so probably I'll just punctuate it briefly, but it is about class. We really want to see that change, then we're going to have to go to the bedrock of all the things that divide us, and it will be class struggle. The socioeconomics speak to the very heart of attitude change, because we can have these conversations about how diagnosis matters, but if you are from a social capital that says, no, it doesn't, it's not a thing that you want to have with your name attached to it, then how are we going to address that? And that means looking at barriers preventing that being a source of confidence or pride or bridge building. So otherwise we're just going to sleepwalk into this, here's the right kind of autistic person because they can champion it. Here's the wrong kind of autistic person because they cannot. The psychological consequences, I'm going to say, I think it's because the audience deserves it, but it's tough language, right? Black men are more likely to kill themselves than any other group in this country. After that's Roma gypsies. The underdiagnosis perhaps is a conversation for black men, but I'm actually probably more worried about learning isolation, about what that does as a travesty, rather than rushing to do a diagnosis. And that might be contradictory, but I'm trying to think, how do we build an inclusive learning environment and a space-making environment that doesn't build on the legacies of so many communities that have stories to tell? So there's no simple answer on this. It really would be, but I think we're dangerously being trite if we are going to give a simple answer. But it is saying outright is that these conversations deserve going to the class roots that prevent people from accessing positive attitudes around them. And what do we do to own that? And a big part of owning that is also giving way, that some of those stories can be told without reinforcing the conversations that are just comfortable in perhaps in middle-class white settings. And then we can have a more of a cohesive space around what neurodiversity looks like, and fundamentally, the richness of what it deserves to look like.
Thank you, Teef. I think, Elliot, were you wanting to say something as well?
Yeah, it keeps coming and going from my brain because it's, as Teef says, so complicated. But I think, just to echo, I guess, what you're saying, Teef, like, I completely agree. And I think the problem is, if it's still down to somebody privileged to decide which types of marginalization are acceptable or okay, then that's just reinforcing the existing problem. And I think, like you were saying about labels, I don't think I realized until like a year or so ago that the reason that I find labels useful for myself is because fundamentally I don't think I feel confident to believe that I'm okay the way I am unless I have language to explain it. And so I feel like, not that this is a particular solution, but I guess the ideal situation would be to be able to feel okay without the language, but also for society, higher education, the way we do things, I guess, in a Eurocentric way, to not need to have an explanation to be able to treat other people compassionately, I guess. Like, not withholding compassion behind, like, not gatekeeping it behind understanding or agreeing, or like not needing proof before you decide somebody else's needs and experiences are legitimate. So that's it, but it's not exactly a step-by-step, you know, guide, is it?
Thank you. I have a second question that I wanted to ask, unless Mary or Jill, you wanted to say anything on that.
Yeah, can I come in on this one? It's an area that is very close to my heart, and this is where I get controversial, because I think it is such an important question that we need to address, and it's really not being addressed within the neurodiversity movement in general. It's not, and I think there are differences within the wider neurodivergent community. You know, autistic people have different challenges to those who are not autistic but would have a diagnosis of ADHD, for example. And then people who have a diagnosis of dyslexia or dyspraxia, they are just different, you know, different challenges. And I think sometimes we can get into a situation where sort of individual groups tend to want to just focus on one area and not think about kind of the wider perspective. But then what ends up happening is there's just sort of conflict and almost competition between, you know, between diagnostic groups. And I just think that's a real shame because, again, and particularly within the autistic community, I mean, you know, if anybody's involved in the autistic community, I mean, it's like there's a lot of cliques, factions, groupings, you know, like there's a lot of conflict. And to the sort of the people to whom we want to appeal in terms of moving the agenda forward, that can just look like a mess of conflict. And it can look like we're just too difficult to deal with. We're just too difficult to engage with. And that happens in the research world, that happens in education, that happens in healthcare, that happens in policy. And I just think until we address it, it's an issue that's really difficult to get over. And I think in terms of moving forward, how do we come together? There's one movement that I see, you know, see as a sort of an ideal way to do things. And like, you know, it's an Irish group, so it may not resonate, you know, for UK or worldwide audience, but we recently had a referendum in Ireland because we had a constitutional prohibition on termination of pregnancy. And there was a lot of political activism to try and get that changed. And there was a group of there was lots of different groups who were campaigning on this, all of whom wanted the same outcome, but for very, very different reasons. And the campaign was, you know, looked like it was about to fall apart. Simply because there was just so much infighting going on and, you know, fighting, in between different groups. And then there was a movement that was called Together for Yes. And it was basically all these groups came together under one single umbrella. Groups that would never be seen in the same room together, never mind sharing a platform, but they all wanted the same thing. And it was an absolute model of how to do cohesive advocacy with disparate groups. I'd love to see something like that happen. How to make it happen, I don't know. But I really do think that, you know, that is what we need. If we want to see if we want to see wider cultural change, if we want to see, you know, real changes in society that benefit all members of our neurodivergent community, I do think we need to think about cohesion and we need to think about how we move forward together. And I think that's one of the reasons that we've been successful in ADI, Autistic Doctors International, ADI, because from the beginning, we've had a set of principles that have kind of guided, you know, the advocacy that we do. And one of those principles is putting group cohesion above individual issues. And it has really, I think, served us very well because we haven't had any, you know, any significant difficulties. We haven't had any significant splits that are so common to other autistic groups. And I would somehow love to see that just broadened out and for us all in the neurodivergent community to be working together, you know, for the benefit of everybody. Again, it's difficult because we in ADI, particularly, we do our advocacy around autism. And that's very much what we do. That's very much our brand. And while we do always widen that out, like I'll always talk about autism and neurodiversity, but I'm usually asked to talk about autism. You know, I'm not usually asked to talk about other conditions. And I'm not qualified to talk about other conditions. So it is, it's really difficult. But I do think that we really need to address it and find a way to work together.
Thank you, Mary. Jill, did you want to add anything at this point?
I guess just a reflection that this conversation has been really valuable and insightful for me. And I've been reflecting on Latif's kind of comment around this acceptable neurodiversity. And I think I really see that experience in my work And I think in the training that I had in speaking neurotypical and in the privilege that I bring in terms of my collective privilege, but particularly my ability to speak neurotypical, I think is a strong one, and being white and being part of an organisation that is known and recognised, and the connections and relationships that I've been afforded because of that, what I see is in a lot of the conversations that I have, people say, "Oh yeah, someone else said that," or "Oh yeah, I heard that," or so often actually what I'm delivering isn't new information, but but people are able to hear it from me. So and I think that really speaks to this kind of accept, like, you know, who will we listen to, who will be heard, who will be respected, and I see with some of my colleagues that, you know, if their tonal presentation isn't what's expected, then, you know, they're kind of not invited back. So I'm really reflecting on my role in echoing and supporting the voice of others, and in making sure that when I need to take a stand, I do, but also that I move myself out of the way. And I think that it's kind of, yeah, an important but quite a tough balance to navigate. And I'm curious and reflective around whether I'm getting this right and how I can do more and better. So I'm grateful for the prompts and reflections around that.
Thank you. Yeah, me too. And so I've got in the questions from the floor, there's quite a few that are for different panel members, so I can ask them specifically to one person, but other people are very welcome to chip in. But there's one that I quite like that's sort of a bit more personal, and that I think maybe, well, you don't have to answer it, but it might be relevant to everyone, which is a question from Carolyn about what the panel's advice would be to their younger selves when they were aged 18, helping them fulfil their potential and celebrate their strengths. What would you say to your 18-year-old self?
Mine would be an easy one, which would be there's lots, but to start with was just make eye contact. Something I didn't do at 18, I didn't look at people. And it was something I deeply wasn't aware, because I'd just normalized conversations where I'd look at the floor or look away, or mostly look at the floor. And it was a thing that it was in my 20s that I learned to stop doing it, but it took a while. But I also think it was a bedrock to lots of things that were happening, that it was just a way of coping. You know? So there's that. And I suppose largely, you know, and I really like the saying, be the kind of guy, be the kind of person you needed when you were younger. So I suppose it's being open to that. What does that look like? You know, but I definitely think somebody willing to point out that I just don't look at people and practicing with me. Was a good start.
Thank you, Jill.
Thanks. Yeah, I think my advice to my 18-year-old self would be hold on, like keep going. At 18, I was really in the depths of having a difficult time and was without hope. And I didn't have enough life experience at that time to know that things pass. And people kept telling me, like, oh, you know, childhood or being young, it's the best years of your life. And I was just like, can't face things getting any worse. And so, yeah, I think a lot in my work, what I see is people between like 12 and 25, 28, around that age group, I think often is the time when this isn't true for everyone, but a lot of us really struggle, really notice the difference, really fall behind, particularly in the social, emotional processing and engagement. And it took me time to find my groove and to find my place and to find my people. And at that time, my hobbies and interests were not appreciated, and I didn't have other people to share them with. And that's changed with time. So I think, yeah, my advice would be hold on. It changes, it passes, it gets better. Give yourself an opportunity to find your place in the world.
Thank you. Elliot?
It's hard because I'm not sure what I could say to make myself believe it, but I think I would probably say something about like I'm fine as a person, even if I'm not trying hard all the time. I really, for a long time, really believed that, for some reason, I didn't have whatever it was that one needed to be allowed to judge how I felt about my own behavior. I'm not talking about impacts on others. I mean, that's obviously crucial. But even if I knew how what I'd done or said impacted on everyone else, somehow it would really be up to someone else to decide whether I was still okay as a human being or as a person. And to be able to know at that age that when somebody else said something was wrong or bad or not okay, they probably meant that they didn't really like it. And of course, from there, there's decisions about what you want to do and balancing impacts and priorities. But I really honestly, fundamentally was just constantly waiting for someone to point out the way in which I'd suddenly done something terrible and inherently bad this time. And it always felt like there was just something waiting to come out of nowhere to kind of, I don't know, launch onto the why I was such a terrible person thing. And so I think knowing that that's not real, I suppose, and that absolutely different ways of being will have different consequences, but that it's not like other people were sort of better qualified to decide whether who I was okay or not. That would have been hard to learn, but useful.
Thank you. Mary, did you want to give any advice to your 18-year-old self?
Yeah, just wait. Similar to Jill, maybe for a slightly different reason, but yeah, just wait. You will find your tribe. That's what I needed to know back then. And I didn't know back then. And it did happen. It was exactly what I needed. I also needed to know that it was okay to be solitary, that I didn't have to battle the social expectations to be sociable, to be popular, to be, you know, part of the in crowd. I didn't have to do that. I didn't want to do that. And yet the expectation was that I would. And that just took so much energy and so much effort. I wish I had been told back then. I wish somebody had told me, and it's what I would tell my younger self. It's okay. Stay home with a book. That's fine. Those two things.
Thank you. I'm going to move on to some of the questions from the floor. Some of them are sort of for more specifically for one speaker or two speakers, but other people can potentially jump in if you like. So I'm going to start with a question that I think is probably more for Elliot and Atif, but you know, equally thoughts welcome. So this is from Samir Panja, who says, to what extent is neurodivergence still responded to in HE, higher education, through the deficit model? And in what ways do the panel think that universities can respond more effectively, in particular at a structural level, as Atif mentioned, to encourage a shift towards a more celebratory and growth mindset?
So there are two questions there, really. No, one is, so, and if I interpreted that well, so if I maybe Elliot, you might do a better job than me on this one. But I think that ultimately there's still a heavy emphasis on proving something. The emotional dissection itself, again, can be leaned into by some, not leaned into by others, and forced to be leaned into because it's the only way of coping in a sense of presence. The psychological harm there is just so profound. So can HEs do anything about it? Well, absolutely. I mean, it's really the auspices of the social model to anticipate difference, to recognize that some people won't have the social capital to to advocate for that difference. They're not really profoundly difficult things to do. And institutions have research institutions within them that are telling them this all the time. So the struggle is that we have inherited silos, and I guess those silos have helped us categorize people and categorize differences. But the difficulty is that we have, and I'll put resources in the chat, and I'll put free links to everything to help people watching this as well, including free assistive technology, is, you know, if I get a book from a library and it's about Agatha Christie, I don't have to prove I'm a detective. If I get a book from the same library at the same time on kerosene fuel, I don't have to prove I'm a rocket scientist. I don't have to do anything. I can just join up in the library and take what I need. But when it comes to saying I need assistive technology or a screen reader or something to help me just cope with being at university, I have to prove a whole bunch of stuff despite all the work that's gone into being there in the first place, or the courage it takes to walk up and down and tell a person that you don't necessarily know what it takes to be you and what it is that's frightening about being you. Now, for others, they can normalize that because they've come to terms with maybe assisted neurodiversity younger in their life and they've had advocacy and support. But there'll be white people here that are listening that have grown up in social care, but they haven't had that agency or that support. And there'll be brown people, as I said enough on already, that will not have the conviction to know that this is a safe place to ask for those things, and there are repercussions for them. Already in the workplace, too many people come forward because of job protection, not because of diversity of thought or the celebration of that, but because they've been KPI'd, they've been performance indicated, and so to come forward is about job protection. If we think we're still having a neurodiversity conversation in that context, we're not. We're having a mental health conversation with our families and ourselves about whether we can financially afford this situation we're in. So it can be done easily, and it's a question of really about what do we lose if we don't. Can a HGI really say we've got bad reputation, people are leaving us, or they're not comfortable, or there's even mental health loss or something far worse than that, which is happening to universities around the country at times, that we lose people's lives. So the work there is to be able to recognize that and to say, look, so we can have a position here that anticipates that, we can have a position here that welcomes it, and we can have a position here as a university to say, every time we support people in this, they're an ambassador for us. And when they support us, they go, be they Chinese students afraid to talk about autism, but in terms of global governance, they go back to China and say, this is the university I went to, and this is the courage they gave me to talk about differences, and these are the creations that I made at this most famous STEM university in the world. And that offering can be to Chinese, Indian students, as it can be to anybody, regardless of class background, if the institution chooses to make it so.
Thank you. Elliot?
I mean, I absolutely agree with everything Atif said. I think the challenge is, like, absolutely, they could. Will they? And how could we make that happen? I think there's so much focus on kind of policing students in fear of cheating. Like, that seems to be prioritized above most other things. So people care a lot about making sure people don't cheat, but they don't seem to care quite as much about making sure people aren't discriminated against or treated incompassionately or dehumanized. Somehow one of those things is considered the absolute hard line, which we absolutely can't ignore, which is, are people cheating or lying or making it up so they get extra things? You can, I'm sure, tell I don't particularly value that particular take, that that's the way, you know, the idea of that being the thing we should focus on, but it seems like we don't, not us, but like structurally there is less consideration of the importance of not dehumanizing people. And I think part of it is that so much of it happens in higher education institutions across the UK, at least, that everyone's in denial. And because at this point, if they accepted the amount of that stuff that goes on, they would all be in for a lot of reputational damage. I mean, there's just so much issues with the fact that there are, like, I don't know what you think, but like, I think interactions with individuals who are in power over us, like in general, can, I suppose, sorry, I'm trying to think of the way to phrase it, and it's complicated, so I'm a bit stuck. My point is, it's absolutely a systemic issue, but the way that we often experience those systemic issues is through the attitude, behavior, and decisions of people in positions of power, for example, in higher education institutions. And the thing that I find really difficult is, like, what do we do? Like, I guess, like, I don't know, from what do we do as, if we could change structural, if we change things structurally, what can we do to stop the behavior that chooses to take an uncompassionate and dehumanizing approach? Like, how would that be done? Because I absolutely think things are done along the deficit model. And I just don't know, like, I obviously my work is trying to stop that from happening, but it seems to be so difficult for people to understand that people being different is not in fact inherently bad. And so many people seem to feel pressured to be classroom managers and to be making sure people behave in the correct way. And I suppose when they're guided by that, that's their motivation, that's the thing that they feel is important, then their behavior will probably align with that. And that usually results in really problematic supremacist positions. So, yeah, I guess I think it should change, but I'm not sure how it would, like, systemically. Unless the university is actually willing to be humble and accept that maybe the ways of doing things, whether consciously or unconsciously, may have done be doing harm, and actually commit to prioritizing not doing harm. I don't think without that that anything is going to meaningfully change at a systemic level.
Thank you. Jill?
Thanks. So I don't have experience myself of higher education. But I just want to speak to the change that I do see. So, and kind of the need for the kind of the parallel planning. I really, really echo the desire and the need for structural change. And without that, we're not going to get a wholesale change. And I see the power and the phenomenal difference that individuals are making in adapting their approaches. And it shouldn't be down to the individual who's working in spite of the system. I see the difference that makes to individuals, and I see how those stories spread and that influence spreads and the opportunity that comes with that. I think often the change is grassroots and kind of bottom up rather than top down. So I emphasizing the need for both and to spot and share and champion those places where that work is happening and where those individuals are making accommodations and differences and the impact it's having. And, you know, like Atif said, you know, those stories spread and the reputation grows in that way, and it is often down to individuals rather than institutions, rather than systems.
Thank you. Elliot, did you want to say something?
Really quickly, you're absolutely right. Like, I completely agree with you, Jill. I think the reason I'm just realizing that, like, because so much of the work that I do is with various individuals, I see the structural barriers that they are facing, like huge amounts of workloads, and I see them pushing up against things that are barriers for them being able to do more or be able to stay well whilst doing things. And I think that's why I was focusing on that. But you're absolutely right that, like, the people that I see, you know, working towards a better future for these things are just inspirational and incredible. And just because of their compassion and the way that they're treating other people, it's incredible.
Thank you. Right, I'm going to try and ask at least a couple of questions before we finish. We've got some very really interesting stuff, but limited time. I think I'll ask maybe there's an interesting one from Rick, who says, a medical diagnosis is a valuable moment for many, as neurodivergent voices and perspectives are so routinely erased, and we don't get to see and understand ourselves in the world or the mainstream media. However, it's also deeply pathologising and adds to prejudice and marginalisation. Other marginalised groups were historically and incorrectly described as a pathology. What are the benefits of moving to a post-diagnosis world, and how do we ensure we maintain our rights? Then, anybody want to share any thoughts on that issue? Atee.
Time doesn't allow that question to give that question justice, really. It doesn't. It's a great question, though. Thank you for asking it. Yeah, look, we are pathologizing things because we've used a medical model and we're currently keeping a medical model well and truly alive. The DSA is designed around a medical model, for example, which is why we end up with folks who are able to advocate or exhausted to or find out how to because of that stress point at times, and others still don't use it. I personally didn't get to know it existed. Again, it's a story of social capital, but I managed to not know there was a grant or a fund that could support you. But you'd have to have word of mouth for knowing. The answer to the question is, how do you do it? Well, you build inclusive. If you think about higher education, is there a head argument as well as a heart argument to say an inclusive campus creates more participation, it reduces mental health, it raises the profile of our institutions, and it shows us how we could be real torchbearers for that diversity of thought in the leading places in the world that we are watching even elitist institutions still struggling to for that student body. So there is a head argument for that, but it is going to require us to move into a social model that's barrier driven, to recognize not the diagnosis that matters, but what the barriers people face. Being a single mother is a barrier. It might not be a disability, but it is a disabling situation if you can't attend a lot of the meetings and you have to rush early and your career is being hampered because you're not networking. And it's putting the context of so many things of what is a disabling situation, not what's the name of something or the name of something you've got. Even if you talked about, cerebral palsy, it affects one person to another. So what is the barriers they face? What are the roots of that? So we are going to need to move beyond pathologizing it into an idea that perhaps, and this is not necessarily popular, but perhaps we're all neurodiverse, but we're just not all marginalized because of it. And that's the work to do, and to recognize that we are all collectively losing things. And it's not just my liberation that's dependent on it. If Elliot, for example, isn't doing well, or Jill isn't doing well, or Mary, but that my liberation is dependent on them doing well. And so is theirs. But the heart of this is that people, I think, are going to want some overnight successes. And I just think we are in an exciting place. And I say this with real grace, I hope, and enthusiasm. I mean it, that this is an intergenerational discussion. And yet it hasn't gone nearly where it deserves to be. But like I said, I don't think this is worth throwing the towel in because it hasn't gone to the spaces that people deserve to see it. But it is about saying, look, this is going to take time. But it's bloody exciting what's on the other side of it.
I might come in on that one and just say that while I absolutely see the benefits of not pathologizing, and that's very much where my advocacy is focused. I mean, it's for us, it's all around a neurodiversity affirmative approach to autism and other forms of neurodivergence. But I just want to also raise the issue of the risks of moving away from diagnosis, and in particular for those people who have significant challenges associated in particular with being autistic. And I think that is one of the things that, it's a challenge for us in the wider neurodivergent community, just how to include everybody, because there is that risk of, sometimes people with higher support needs being excluded from the conversations. And I think it's really important that we collectively don't allow that to happen, because there's a significant minority of autistic people who have very high support needs, in various domains. And I think there is also a societal and political risk, I think, of, stripping people of of those supports and stripping people of benefits and, you know, social care and access to support that we just need to be very mindful of in that conversation.
Thank you. Did anyone else want to say anything on that question? Yeah, Elliot.
I'm aware it's like a tiny, tiny, tiny bit of a tangent, but I think the thing alongside that, like, I absolutely agree with what you're saying. I'm thinking about the question, not about disagreeing with your response. I was thinking about the fact that there are still lots of diagnoses, labels, conditions within the umbrella of neurodiversity that people that are so pathologized that it would be extremely dangerous for many, like almost anyone, to come out with them. So I'm thinking about dissociative identity disorder there, which is one that people might not be familiar with and isn't talked about as much, but it's not something I'm an expert on, so I apologize if I've gotten this a bit wrong, but essentially it's the concept of having like multiple people existing in the same body, and that doesn't need to be pathologized. It's often referred to as like plurality or multiplicity, but it's one of those things that I think people feel they have to be absolutely secret about often because of the way that it's represented in the media and the danger that might come of being open about that sort of thing. So I guess I'm not sure quite what like clever thing I should say about linking that to the need for diagnosis or lack thereof, but I think it's just to keep in mind also that there are some diagnostic labels that even in themselves having them can bring harm or danger potentially if it's on medical records. And so I feel I've really rambled, so I'm going to stop now. I do believe, like, I find my own labels extremely helpful, and I just hate the fact that there's some where they might be met with such a like strong negative response.
Thank you. I'm really aware that we're coming up to 1:30, and I promised to finish at 1:30. And I there's been so many great questions asked, but I'm hoping that they are going to, you know, that I'm going to save them, and they're going to be, you know, potentially future events, future discussions. You know, I'm sure we can bring those questions into the conversation. And thank you very much to everyone. Did any of the panel have anything more brief to say before I kind of before I sum up? Yeah, Atif.
I wanted to pose a question, which has come up a couple of times in this chat. I don't expect an answer, but I'm quite interested in it. I hear it quite often about the neurodiversity community, you know, and I have real hope in that, just the word, the neurodiverse community. But I hear it around me as if it said in conviction that it's a tangible community. And I'm interested in that. And I guess where I'm interested in asking as a provocation, but it's meant with love, is there such a thing as a neurodiversity community? In which case, what does it look like? And I suppose I'll just stop there. And I am wondering, I suppose to illustrate, I sometimes wonder myself, is there? I hear it a lot. And I'm not saying it isn't, doesn't exist. I'm just saying, it's what does it look like? Because it will tell us a lot.
Thank you. That is also a great question. I don't know if anybody else wants to attempt to say anything about it in about a minute, or if that is a good point at which to leave us all thinking. And Elliot?
I think maybe it ties in with that idea that when, you know, we're all different, even within the same label. And I agree that the idea of a neurodiversity or neurodivergent community is a very monolithic phrase that suggests that, like, you know, we all are the same because we all fit into the community and it's just this one thing. And of course, I imagine it is much, much more complicated than that.
Thank you. And just thank you so much to our panelists. I feel like I've learned a lot. And when I go through and listen again several times, I will learn more when I'm not kind of worrying about webinar admin at the same time.
So on which note, I apologise. People can't see the chat. This is my fault, but I will share those links with Eva afterwards, along with the video, to which I will add subtitles, captions. So that is going to be made available on our Westminster blog, neurodiversity blog site. And that will be shared with people, because I know there were some people who weren't able to make it, but did very, very much say they wanted to see it afterwards. And just to let you know that we've got an event for which booking is now open as well on March the 21st, a hybrid panel on neurodiversity, architecture and cities, hosted by my school, the School of Architecture and Cities. And there will be more happening. But yeah, just thank you very much all for attending. I'm sorry I didn't get to ask most of your questions, which were all great, but I just thought the discussion was so interesting. I didn't like to shut people up, and think hopefully people got a lot out of it. And thank you. Yeah, just thank you so much. I really.